Okay. Now, as I said, since we have been away from this part of the study for several weeks, let me use the board here to sort of briefly review some material. I handed out a sheet of paper, I believe, at the last class, which I have more copies of. I'll make available at the end of this class, that shows the correlation between the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24, Luke 21, and Mark 13, I believe it is, between what we're reading now in this part of the book of Revelation. Does anybody not, I don't know, I never know quite how to phrase this. Does anybody need for me to explain to them what the Olivet Discourse is? Everybody knows what we're talking about. Okay. So, I have told you on many occasions, and I'll probably tell you in a few more, that my thinking is, and those of many other people who have studied these matters, is that what we have in the book of Revelation is an extended panoramic version of what's given to us in Matthew 24 and Luke 21 and Mark 13. But you don't find the Olivet Discourse anywhere in the Gospel of John. And if we can assume for a moment that the John who wrote the Gospel of John is the same John who wrote the book of Revelation, and that is a traditional assumption, then it is remarkable that it's not present in his Gospel, but it is present in the other three, and yet we have this other book written by him that bears striking resemblance to what is compressed into one or two or two and a half chapters in these other Gospels, and here occupies an entire book. So that's why I'm saying that what we find in this is an expanded panoramic version of what Jesus said on the Mount of Olives. And it really is panoramic. The sheet gives you some sort of verse-by-verse comparison between Revelation 6, 7, and 8 and the Olivet Discourse. As I said, again, I'll hand those copies out again to those who may need them. And we will have occasion, as you see from this side, to compare what we read here in the sixth seal, which was where we left off last time at the fifth seal, and see how even more striking it is, the language that is being used in the book of Revelation compared to the Olivet Discourse. And then we'll go back even further to the prophet Joel and see it has roots even there. Now, we said that in terms of the seals that were being opened from the scroll, and I made the case, or at least attempted to, that the scroll would call to mind, most likely in the mind of a Hebrew Christian reading this book of Revelation, in light of everything else that's going on here, a writ of divorcement. It is a written document, a legal action, where God is bringing the sanctions against his adulterous wife, Israel. We find the same language used in the Old Testament when they committed spiritual adultery and were carried off by the Assyrians or Babylonians. And we are now seeing the same thing coming into with the change from the Old Covenant into the New Covenant as the ultimate act of covenant breaking is taking place with the rejection of the Messiah. Now, the first of the seals is broken, and a white horse appears. The rider is wearing a bow and a crown. He conquers. There's various imagery associated with that. But the key thing is the context that we see here, what we learn from the Olivet Discourse, and what we see, it bears strong resemblance here, is that this entire book, or at least 99.9% of it, is about the destruction that God was bringing upon Israel in the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple there. And so this white horse is a prefiguring of, or speaking of, that destruction that was either taking place or shortly to take place. The red horse is symbolic of war and killing. It says there in Revelation 6 that he had a great sword, which is symbolic of great destruction. This is a good example, sort of a microscopic example of how this kind of language is used. John didn't say, and he went forth and killed a whole bunch of people. They didn't write that way back then. They didn't think that way back then. But the idea of him having a great sword, a large sword, would mean that he was going to kill a lot of people. All right, the third horse is the black horse. He is carrying with him an imagery of scales or balances. And we talked about how food was measured out in those days using scales. And on the heels of warfare generally come famine. And I gave you a couple of examples from the writings of the Jewish historian Josephus of the horrific famine that struck the city of Jerusalem when the Romans had laid siege to it beginning in AD 66, culminating in its destruction in AD 70 I'll be sharing a little more with you about Josephus and from his writings as we move on. And then there is the pale horse, which speaks of death and pestilence. And then the next seal was the fifth seal, and it didn't portray any riders on horses, but rather martyrs who were underneath the altar. And I told you something about the technology of the sacrificial system of the Old Covenant, whereby the animals were slain, the sacrificial offering was slain, and the blood would trickle down underneath the altar. It's a symbolic of sacrificial bloodletting. And the martyrs pictured here under the altar in a place of special righteousness. And they're crying out to God for vengeance. Now, that brings us then to the sixth seal. And if you would, please locate Revelation chapter 6 and verse 12. The opening of this sixth seal, it calls forth imagery that likewise is highly reminiscent of the words of Jesus in the Olivet Discourse. But let's read the passage first, Revelation 6 verses 12 through 17. And I'm reading from the Old Revised Standard Version, the old RSV. When he opened the sixth seal, I looked, and behold, there was a great earthquake. And the sun became black as sackcloth, the full moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as the fig tree sheds its winter fruit when shaken by a gale. The sky vanished like a scroll that is rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth and the great men and the generals and the rich and the strong and everyone slave and free hid in the caves among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand before it?" Now, the obvious connection between these words and those from the Olivet Prophecy are strikingly apparent when you compare the two. Now, what I want you to do is turn to Matthew 24 and locate verse 29 and keep your hand there in Revelation 6. We're going to do some sort of back and forth switching here. Matthew 24, and then we'll look back at Revelations 12 through 14. Matthew 24, verse 29. And you see there, in this part of the Olivet Prophecy, Jesus is speaking, and he says in verse 29, "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened." Now let's understand, the operating assumption we have here is that what Jesus is speaking of in Matthew 24 and the parallel passages in Luke 21 and Mark 13 is the destruction of Jerusalem. That's the setting. He's in the temple, or he's at the temple, and the disciples say, "Look at all these stones, and look at this beautiful place, how great it is." And he says, "I'm going to tell you, not one stone is going to be left upon another." And then he launches into this discussion in very prophetic language to talk about what that is. Now, look at it again. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened. Now, turn back to Revelation 6 and look at verse 12. When he opened the sixth seal, behold, there was a great earthquake. The sun became black as sackcloth. You see the parallel there. Now turn back to 24:29. Keep your place in Revelation 6. He says also in verse 29, "And the moon will not give its light." Turn back to Revelation 6. Look at verse 12. "And the moon became like blood." Well, what does that mean? It means it's not giving its light. It's a different way of saying it, but it's saying essentially the same thing. All right, turn back to Matthew 24, 29. "And the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken." Turn back to Revelation 6, look at verses 13 to 14. "And the stars of the sky fell to earth, and the sky vanished like a scroll that is rolled up." So you see, you've got this imagery here that's almost verbatim. If it's not word for word, it's thought for thought, the same kind of thing. Now the question is, and this is where we begin to part company, or at least I do. Pardon me if I'm attempting to speak for you and you don't want to go down this path. This is where I part company, and I know at least several of you do, with our dispensationalist and futuristic friends who want to see in this some sort of dire prediction of cosmic destruction, literally. it's easy enough, I suppose, to take that position when you don't understand the nature of biblical language and the context in which all of this comes. This is the way these people talked and spoke about things. And that example of the rider carrying the great sword is a typical example. They use language like this. Great sword doesn't mean he had a great big sword. It meant to convey an idea of massive destruction. Now I want you to turn to Joel chapter 2. There's yet another biblically based parallel to the opening of the sixth seal found in this book of Joel. And in the book of Joel chapter 2, it reads as follows in verses 30 to 31. I'll give you a chance to find it. If you need to look in your table of contents to see what pages it's on, that's fine. I won't look at you while you do it. Sometimes I have to do the same thing. Joel chapter 2, verses 30 to 31. Okay, I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. Now, before I go any further, let's stop right there a moment. I suppose that a dispensationalist or a futurist might say, well, now, wait a minute. Why can't they all be talking about the same thing? This second coming of Jesus at the end of time in which the Antichrist will come and there'll be this cosmic destruction and all this. That is a question that can only be asked when you have an idea about end times and prophetic language that you've already received or it's been given to you or you formulate it and then you go back to the Bible with it. Because you're not starting with what Joel is talking about. Why is Joel saying these things? Who was this guy Joel? Why was he talking like this? See, that never seems to occur to these people when they make these kind of jumping, you know, acrobatic hermeneutical yoga, as one person called it, where they strew together all these verses without paying any attention to why the things were being said in the first place. In these verses, highly metaphorical and symbolic language and imagery is used to portray a, quote, coming of the Lord. And the book of Joel is full of prophetic speech that speaks of Yahweh's judgment coming upon an idolatrous and spiritually adulterous nation of Israel. That's what was going on at the time Joel was writing. The people of Israel, this is long before the coming of the Messiah, the people of Israel had become spiritually adulterous. And these sorts of sins had brought down the wrath of God upon them. Somebody tell me, I've already mentioned it once, I want you to tell me, what was the highest visible manifestation in the older covenant time of this covenant wrath that God brought on Israel? What was it? They were taken captive. There was something else that happened, though. That's the major part of it, but what did their captors do to the city? They destroyed Jerusalem, or near about destroyed it. The Jews had to rebuild the temple. That's what's going on in Ezra and Nehemiah. So God has already shown this once before, and it's interesting. This is what Joel is talking about, and he's using this language. Is it now to be supposed that the author of the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation, just coincidentally happens to draw upon the same language? Surely not. The rules of proper interpretation and common sense, frankly, limit the implications. In other words, make it very improper to make these kind of leaps and jumps in the words of Revelation 6 to the occurrence of a similar, though far more disturbing, pattern of spiritual rebellion in that day. That's what the Apostle John is talking about here in Revelation. He is addressing a matter of profound, even far more profound than Joel was addressing, spiritual rebellion. Think of the context. Joel was speaking out of great concern because the priests of Israel, the people of Israel, had no more regard for God and His law and the sacrifices and the rituals. They simply had become lackadaisical about those things. Or perhaps many of them had taken on beliefs and practices of the pagan religions. They had intermarried with pagan families, and so they had adopted, and God was angry with this. And that was enough over a span of generations to bring God's wrath down on them to the point where they were carried off into captivity as Israel, the city of Jerusalem was sacked and destroyed. How much greater is that wrath going to be when it's not just simply they say, we have no king but Caesar, but they also crucify the only begotten Son, the Messiah? Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost, it's fitting, therefore, that John, the author of the Apocalypse, calls upon this time-honored and well-known language of the Old Covenant prophets to speak of the spiritual rebellion that he was focusing on in his day. And he's not the only one who's done this. Peter, in his sermon on the day of Pentecost, he provides you, the reader, with an additional time frame reference for understanding how these words in Revelation 6 would most likely have been understood by the intended audience. Turn to Acts chapter 2, and we're going to look at several verses between verses 14 and 40, not the entire section there, but I want you to get a flavor of this because Peter quotes Joel as well, some of the same wording here. How do we know that the book of Revelation is not talking about something way, way off into the distant future? How can we have any confidence, any certainty, any assurance that he's speaking of things that were happening in his day and time? Well, the Bible tells us this. It's just the problem is, as I said, we bring these sort of preconfigured notions that we've been taught or we absorb through the popular evangelical culture to the Bible, and we sort of are blinded to this. How many times have you, I've had this happen to me. Well, you're letting your beard grow. I've had this beard since 1987. And all of a sudden, some people just sort of notice that I have it. Or I'll walk into a room and I say, has that picture always been hanging there? You ever done that? It's the same thing with this. This is right here in front of you, but you know. But Peter, this is Acts 2:14. Peter, standing up with the 11, raised his voice and said, now this is, the events of Pentecost have taken place. For these are not drunken, as you suppose, since it is only the third hour of the day. But this is that which, notice, this is that which is spoken by the prophet Joel. Notice he is locating in that time and in that place the fulfillment of what Joel was talking about. This is what Joel's talking about. And it shall come to pass in the last days. Do you see the logic here? Do I need to spell this out? Joel says this is going to happen in the last days. This stuff is happening on the day of Pentecost. Peter says, this is it. So when are the last days? This time frame between the crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus and the destruction of the old covenant order, which was finalized in AD 70. Those are the last days. God says, I will pour out of my spirit, and he goes on, and notice verse 19 of Acts 2, I will show wonders in heaven above and signs in the earth beneath, blood and fire, vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood, before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. And it shall come to pass that whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. Now you see, if we're going to accept Peter at his word and believe what the Bible says, that the phenomena that were taking place on the day of Pentecost are exactly what Joel was talking about, then if we're taking a literalistic interpretation, then we've got to have all these manifestations of the moon and the blood and all this kind of thing, and the vapor and the smoke. And what I don't want you to get confused about is that this is metaphorical language, and I'm going to make the case about this in this last point here about the tribulation, decreation, cosmic disorder. These people drew upon this kind of language to talk about the crumbling of the social and religious and political order. When I preached through the book of Revelation, through the first 17 chapters anyway, back in 1999, some of you may remember, I had I held up some printed out images of national flags. And one of the things that I showed you was that many of these flags have crescent moons, stars, planets. And you see, even in our day, it's not unusual that we associate social and political and governmental order with heavenly bodies. That's not, it's one of those things that's common. What does our flag has on it? Stars? How many? Not where I'm from. Some of you know what I'm talking about. But you got these heavenly bodies that have this correspondence, and you got the same thing going here with the decreation, the devolution of the social and political and religious order of Israel. They're drawing on this kind of imagery to talk about how momentous that is. And then Peter says in verse 22, "Men of Israel, hear these words of Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested by God to you." Here's another time indicator. He's speaking to those people. He's saying, to you, he attested these things, miracles and wonders and signs which God did through him, as you yourselves know. How many of you here today were there on the day of Pentecost when Peter said that? None of you. He wasn't speaking to you. He was speaking to these people. They were there. And it gets even more localized and more personalized. He says in verse 23, "You have taken by lawless hands and have crucified and put to death, whom God raised up. Therefore, let all the house of Israel know that God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ." So what Joel is talking about is being localized and applied to what was happening in that time and in that place. He draws upon these words and locates it there, and that's the application. There's simply no warrant for reading these words as applying to any other generation. And I think the validity of the claim that I've just made can be made all the more plain when the several verses from several New Testament books that speak of the great tribulation of that generation are compared. Now, I want you to do this. Could I have a volunteer to read Matthew 23, 32 to 36? Matthew 23, 32 to 36. I need one volunteer, please. Okay, Joy, Carnes, and I need somebody to read Acts 2, 23. We just read it, but I want it read again. Acts 2, 23. Don, would you read that? And I need somebody to read Revelation 1, 7. Revelation chapter 1, verse 7. Linda DeMeo, and I need somebody to read Revelation 11, verse 8. Revelation 11, verse 8. I've got to have one more volunteer. Who will it be? Okay, Ruth Lintine. I saw your hand first. Thank you. Peter draws upon the words of Joel, and he clearly locates the application of those words and the meaning to the generation and the lifetime of the people to whom he was speaking. There's no warrant for applying those words of Joel or the words of Peter to any other generation in terms of what it actually means. Now, in some sense, the application can be extended. I mean, we all need to be aware of certain things in terms of our commitment to Christ. But in terms of historical occurrences, things that were going to happen historically, in time, there's no warrant for taking it beyond that generation if you're going to go with what the Bible says. All right. And what I want to do is put these verses together to show you they all speak of essentially the same thing. And we'll start with the words of Jesus in Matthew 23, 32 to 36. Hang on just a moment. Jesus is speaking here to the leaders of Israel. Thank you. All right, now, Acts 2:23. Revelation 1:7. And 11 verse 8. Okay, we have in Matthew 23 and Acts 2 the prefigured accusation. Jesus is telling them, you're going to do this. I'm going to send you prophets and you're going to kill them, and all of the righteous blood that you and your forefathers are guilty of is going to come upon that generation. And you're going to pay the price for it. Peter says the same thing to them. You took him by lawless hands and you crucified him and you put him to death. And Revelation 1, verse 7 now, we moved into this panoramic expansion of the Olivet Discourse, and it talks about even they who pierced him, all the tribes of the land, will mourn because of what's happened. And then in Revelation verse chapter 11, verse 8, which we technically have not come to, but we've referred to in a previous class or two, it refers to the great city, which is spiritually called Sodom and Egypt. So this is a great city that's become horribly corrupt. Where is it? Where our Lord was crucified. There can be no mistaking where that is. Now, another notable feature that associates the opening of this sixth seal is the portrayal, as I said, of cosmic upheaval. And you will benefit from knowing that this language is typically used, as I said a moment ago, in Scripture to speak of the necessity of God's people being obedient to the Lord's command. Let me back up. I did not say that a moment ago. Turn with me to Psalm 19, and let's look at verses 1 to 9. Just as the stars and the moon and the sun and the cosmic order you see spoken of here obey their Creator, so too should people do the same. That's the import of this psalm. Psalm 19, 1 to 9. Very familiar psalm. I'm going to read it first of all from the New King James Version, and then I want to read it from the New Living Translation. It gives you a little different take on it, but I think it helps clarify it somewhat. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them He has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoices like a strong man to run its race. It's rising from one end of heaven, and its circuit to the other end, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, etc. Now, let me read that to you again. This is from the New Living Translation. The heavens tell of the glory of God. The skies display His marvelous craftsmanship. Day after day, they continue to speak. What continues to speak? These heavenly bodies. Night after night, they make Him known. They speak with a sound, without a sound or a word. Their voice is silent in the skies, yet their message has gone out to all the earth, and their words to all the world. The sun lives in the heavens where God placed it. It bursts forth like a radiant bridegroom for His wedding. It rejoices like a great athlete eager to run the race. The sun rises at one end of the heavens and follows its course to the other. Nothing can hide from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect. So the point here is just that this cosmic order obeys God and glorifies God, so should you and I do the same thing in obeying God's law. And so it's within the logical, it's within the logic and the context of that kind of language that when God's people break the covenant law, in other words, when disorder and moral chaos among the people comes to the forefront, that, too, is here being portrayed in the Olivet Discourse and in the book of Revelation as chaos and destruction within the cosmic order. And the larger point is to be taken literally. The metaphor and the symbol used to express it is not. So, yes, there is disorder. Yes, there is breakdown. That is the literal part of it. But the cosmic stuff is not, that's just a way of carrying the idea. Now, the rest of chapter 6, verses 15 to 17, speak of the fate of the leaders of Israel as God's covenant wrath comes with finality upon the nation. It's an unspeakable act of rebellion, and they are going to receive the benefit of that action in terms of punishment. Now, this is one of several editions of the works of Josephus that are available. This has his entire, complete and unabridged. It's the Antiquities of the Jews, the Wars of the Jews, and you can see it's four columns, teeny tiny print. You can get, I've got another edition of it that's in five volumes, and you can get it in online computer format, software that contain this. It's also available at some website, so you don't have to buy anything if you have internet access and you can read these works. I want to read to you, first of all, something from the introduction to this revised edition of this was revised in the year 2000, to give you some idea of the importance of this man's writings. And don't just take my word for it, because I have some sort of eschatological axe to grind here. Flavius Josephus, who lived in AD 37 to around 100, is the author of what has become for Christianity perhaps the most significant extra-biblical writings of the first century. His works are the principal source of the history of the Jews from the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes to the fall of Masada in AD 73, and therefore are of incomparable value for determining the setting of later intertestamental and New Testament times. Josephus was born the son of a priest. His name was Joseph ben Matthias. Being of a priestly family and a descendant of the Hasmoneans, he was well educated and rose to a respected position in the Jewish community. After a short association with the Essenes, sort of a mystical sect of Jews that some people theorize that Jesus may have had some contact with, and a somewhat longer period as a disciple of an ascetic hermit named Bannus, he decided at the age of 19 to join the Pharisees. When he was 26, that was the year AD 63, he traveled to Rome and successfully pleaded for the release of some fellow priests who had been sent there to be tried by Nero. As a result of the visit, he returned profoundly impressed by the power of the empire and strongly opposed the Jewish revolt against Rome in AD 66, being convinced of its ultimate futility and fearing the consequences for his nation. Being unable to restrain the rebellion, he reluctantly joined it and assumed a command in Galilee, where he fortified a number of cities, stored up provisions, and trained his army in anticipation of the arrival of Vespasian and his forces. By the spring of AD 67, Josephus and the little that remained of his army had been forced to retreat to the fortified city of Jotapata, where he eventually surrendered. During his subsequent imprisonment, he became directly acquainted with and gained the favor of Vespasian. Now that was a pretty important guy to have in your corner, to say the least. When Vespasian became emperor in AD 69, so you can see, it was a good thing that he knew him pretty well, through rather extraordinary circumstances, Josephus was officially freed. He returned to Jerusalem with Titus, Vespasian's son and future emperor, where he served the Roman commander as an interpreter and mediator. Faced with the inevitability of the Roman forces' ultimate victory, Josephus attempted to convince the Jews holding Jerusalem to surrender and thus save the city. He was, however, unsuccessful. And in AD 70, the city fell to the Romans and was demolished. After the destruction of Jerusalem, Josephus returned to Rome with Titus and settled there as a client of the emperor on an imperial pension, gaining the rights of a Roman citizen and adopting the emperor's family name, Flavius, and began his literary endeavors, which we are the beneficiaries of. Now, let me read to you from Book 6 of the Wars of the Jews. This latter part of Revelation 6, where it talks about the people fleeing into the caves and crying out for the stones to fall on them, he's talking about what the book is prefiguring there is going to be the reaction of some of the leaders and the populace of the city of Israel. They see what's coming down the pike with the way the Romans are advancing. We know historically now that's what that was talking about. And the striking thing is that when we read Josephus' account, how much it parallels what the book of Revelation actually was talking about. He says here, he's talking about the Jews and his efforts to convince them to surrender to the Romans. And he says, as they could not think of surrendering themselves up because of the oath they had taken, nor were strong enough to fight with the Romans any longer upon the square, that is the city square, as being surrounded on all sides and a kind of prisoners already, yet were they so accustomed to kill people that they could not restrain their right hands from acting accordingly. So they dispersed themselves throughout the city and laid themselves in ambush among its ruins to catch those that attempted to desert to the Romans. So here you've got a number of Jews who've been trying to fight the Romans, and now they're hiding out in different places in the city, and they're going to start killing other Jews who tried to desert and go to the Roman side. Accordingly, many such deserters were caught by them and were all slain, for these were too weak by reason of their want of food to fly away from them. So their dead bodies were thrown to the dogs. Now every sort of death was thought more tolerable than the famine, insomuch that although the Jews despaired now of mercy, yet would they fly to the Romans, and would themselves, even of their own accord, fall among the murderous rebels also. Nor was there any place in the city that had no dead bodies in it, But what was entirely covered with those were either killed by the famine or of the rebellion. And all was full of the dead bodies of such as had perished either by that sedition or by that famine. So now, the last hope, which supported the tyrants and that crew of robbers who were with them, he's talking about the Jews now who were running what was left of the city of Israel, of Jerusalem, whether if they could once fly, that is, escape the city, which is what Revelation 6 is talking about, they did not expect to be searched for, but endeavored that after the whole city should be destroyed and the Romans gone away, they might come out again and escape from them. So he's talking about them hiding out in places. And if you know anything about the terrain, there were a lot of little caves and pockets of places where people could do that. This was no better than a dream of theirs, for they were not able to lie hid from either God or from the Romans. Now, he also speaks here to give you another example of what Revelation 6, the latter portion there, is speaking of. He talks about a man by the name of Simon, who was a prominent Jew in the city at the time, and he says, "And here it was that Titus was informed of the seizure of Simon, the son of Gioras, who was made after the manner following. This Simon, during the siege of Jerusalem, was in the upper city, but when the Roman army were gotten within the walls and were laying the city waste, he then took the most faithful of his friends with him, and among them some that were stonecutters with those iron tools which belonged to their occupation, and as a great quantity of provisions as would suffice them for a long time, and let himself and them all down into certain caverns that were not visible above the ground." What is Revelation 6 talking about? It's talking about this very thing. They're going to go into caves to try to escape, but it won't do them any good. "Now, as far as had been digged of old, they went onward along it without disturbance. But where they met with solid earth, they dug a mine underground, and this in hopes that they should be able to proceed so far as to rise from underground in a safe place, and by that means escape. But when they came to make the experiment, they were disappointed of their hope, for the miners could make but small progress, and that with difficulty also, insomuch that their provisions, though they distributed them by measure, began to fail them." In other words, they were running out of food and provisions. "And now Simon, thinking he might be able to astonish and delude the Romans, put on a white frock and buttoned upon him a purple cloak and appeared out of the ground in the place of the temple had formerly been. At first, indeed, those that saw him were greatly astonished, and they stood still where they were." So I guess he was trying to pretend like he was a ghost or some, you know, mythical figure who had risen from the earth. "But afterward, they came near to him and asked who he was. Now Simon would not tell them, but bade them call for their captain. And when they ran to tell him, Terentius Rufus, who was left to command the army there, he came to Simon and learned of him the whole truth and kept him in bonds and let Caesar know that he was taken. Thus did God bring this man to be punished for what was bitter and savage tyranny he had exercised against his countrymen for those who were his worst enemies." And it goes on from there. But you can see that the sort of things that the book of Revelation is talking about really did come to pass. So you have in this both a symbolic, but also, in some cases, a literal fulfillment of these things. The problem is that our dispensational friends in the Left Behind series are looking in the wrong place for the fulfillment of it.